Now, would you turn in your Bibles, please, to Genesis 39? Genesis 39, and we'll read from verse 1. Genesis 39 and verse 1. Now, Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and in field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and after a time his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her or to be with her. But one day when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that, I lifted up my voice and cried out. He left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house." Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home. And she told the same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came in to me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house." As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, "This is the way your servant treated me," his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. Amen. And we know God will always bless the reading of his own inspired word. Well, this morning we're continuing our studies in Genesis, and we come to this well-known incident in the life of Joseph when he is tempted by Potiphar's wife. You will remember from our study last week that at the age of 17, Joseph had been callously stripped, mistreated, and sold as a piece of merchandise to a passing caravan of Ishmaelite merchants who took him and sold him in Egypt. Many teenage boys would have crumbled in despair under such circumstances, but not Joseph. He tenaciously and faithfully held on to God, placing his hope and trust in him. But as his story unfolds in Egypt, we see that things get a lot worse before they get better. And in the chapter that's before us, Joseph is thrown into prison and accused of a crime he didn't commit. But even there, God was working out his plan and his purpose, bringing Joseph into contact with the people he needed in order that his purpose for Joseph would be fulfilled. This morning I want you to notice four things about this, about Joseph. in Potiphar's house. And I want you to notice, first of all, the success that Joseph knew. Joseph was sold to a man called Potiphar and was taken to his home. Now, while there, we're told that he prospered. Look at verses 2 and 3. We're told in verse 2 that the Lord was with Joseph and he became a successful man. The NIV says prospered. And he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. Those words, successful and succeed, there mean that there was a successful outcome to every task that Joseph undertook. He obviously didn't prosper, as the NIV says, materially, for he was a slave without possessions, but he did succeed in the work that he undertook. Now, we've got to ask ourselves, why did he succeed? What factors led to his success? And I think there were four. First of all, on the human level, there was this sense of destiny. Why on earth would Joseph be motivated to rise to such a position in Potiphar's house? Well, I think it goes back, in some part at least, to the dreams in which God revealed to Joseph that he would be given a position of authority. You remember how in chapter 37 he was given two dreams in which he saw his 11 brothers and even his father and mother bow down to him. And as I said last week, those dreams weren't the product of too much cheese at bedtime or a vivid imagination, but they were divine revelation. And Joseph believed what God had said. And that sense of destiny for Joseph drove him to make the best of the circumstances in which he found himself in. Proverbs 29 and verse 18 says, where there is no vision, the people perish. Joseph did not sink in despair, nor was he paralyzed into inactivity, because he had vision. He had that sense of destiny. He had something to look forward to. And that's so important. God put eyes in the front of our heads to look forward, not in the back of our heads to look back. Goals and aspirations and ambitions are important and crucial in motivating us in the present to look forward to the future. So that's the first thing then. He had this sense of destiny. Secondly, his success was due to his hard-working industry. Look at verse 5. From the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. Potiphar put him in charge of the household because he was a worker. He took his responsibility seriously. Now think of this for a moment. When Joseph arrived in Egypt, he knew nothing about the history, the language, the culture of Egypt at all. As he was led down by those Ishmaelite traders down the Nile Valley, he would have passed the Great Pyramid, which was already 1,000 years old. Number of years ago, for our 25th wedding anniversary, we went to Egypt, and those pyramids are so impressive. But in those days, they were covered in alabaster, so they shone and glistened in the sun. They give off a pink and a blue sheen. And here's this boy coming from rural Canaan, and he's being led down to one of the most impressive places in the world. Now, Joseph could have kept his head down and played dumb. He didn't know the language and he just could have done the tasks that were assigned to him. But instead, he plunged himself into learning the language, the culture, acquiring the management skills to run a large Egyptian household, which included, of course, according to verse 5, the land. Luther imagines Joseph being first out of bed in the morning and last in bed at night, and studying and accumulating all the knowledge that was necessary to be the best possible slave that he could be. And obviously Potter noticed that characteristic in him and promoted him to a position of authority. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10 says, whatever your hand finds to do, do with all your might. Well, that would have been a good motto for Joseph. He gave himself to hard work. So he was successful because of a sense of destiny, his hard-working industry, and thirdly, his transparent integrity. Look at verse 6. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Joseph ran everything. Everything was left to him. The management of the slaves, the running of the household, the budget, the repairs, the acquisition of new land, investments, all was under his control. All Potiphar had to worry about was the food on his table. Potiphar trusted Joseph implicitly. F.B. Meyer says, though stripped of his coat, he was not stripped of his character. He was a man that Potiphar could trust. Potiphar trusted him implicitly, and that trust was not misplaced, as we shall see later. So Joseph was successful because of this sense of destiny, his hard-working industry, his transparent integrity, and thirdly, and I think most significantly of all, his steadfast loyalty. That's his loyalty to God. You will notice that the text repeatedly attributes his success not to his own resources, but to the Lord. Verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. Verse 3, the Lord caused all that he did to succeed. Verse 5, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. Four times in the chapter, we're told that the Lord was with Joseph. It was the Lord, the Lord, the Lord. Joseph's success was due to the fact that the Lord was with him. I think of this for a moment. Joseph was 17 when he was wrenched from his family, from the shrine, from the land that God had promised, from the family altar. He entered a land that was awash with pagan deities. They had river gods, sun gods, grain gods, animal gods, ancestral gods. Potiphar, the name Potiphar means he who the sun god has given, every type of god imaginable. And it seemed that all these gods had blessed Egypt, because Egypt was one of the richest regions in the world, agriculturally, architecturally, culturally, and educationally. When Joseph arrived, as I said, the Great Pyramid was already 1,000 years old. And this young boy was under pressure to conform and to be absorbed into the culture, and the culture to be absorbed into him. The pressure must have been overwhelming. Quite frankly, his father's altar to Yahweh in Bethel would have appeared a tad primitive in comparison to the altars, the temples, the pyramids in Egypt. But Joseph, in such an environment, remained loyal to his God. He was conscious that God was with him, and he was determined to serve God in this hostile environment. The text seems to suggest that he shared his faith with others even. Look at verse 3. His master saw that the Lord, now notice the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. That's the covenant name for God. Yahweh, or in the olden days, Jehovah. His master saw that Yahweh was with him, and the Lord caused all that he did to succeed. That the Potiphar was aware of the name of his God, and the fact that Joseph attributed all his success to Jehovah. He shared his faith. He remained steadfastly loyal to the Lord. You know how Christian parents worry when their children go off to university, and that they're under this pressure to conform, and they're away from home so that no one will see them. But here's a young boy of 17, deprived of all Christian fellowship. There was no church, in inverted commas, that he could go to be encouraged. There was nothing like that. And yet he maintains his faith in this most hostile of environments. Joseph's success. The success that Joseph saw. And then, secondly, notice the temptation Joseph faced. Here we come to this sordid account of Potiphar's wife's attempted seduction of Joseph. And I want you to notice three things about this temptation. Notice, first of all, it was a strong temptation. We mustn't underestimate the strength of the temptation that Joseph faced. Look at the second half of verse 6 and verse 7. Now, Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." Joseph at this stage would have been perhaps in his early 20s, and we are told that he was handsome in form and appearance. I suppose if we were, if the girls were talking today, they would say that he was fit. During my generation, they would say that he was a bit of a hunk, and my grandparents' generation, he was a very good-looking young man. We're told that she invited Joseph to, well, the NIV says, come to bed. The AV says, lie with me. Now, we know from historical evidence that Egyptian women were very independent and flaunted their sexuality. This probably wasn't the first person she tried to seduce, nor would it be the last. Now, remember, Joseph was a young man with all the appetites that accompany a young man in his 20s. Even in spite of his faith in the Lord Jesus, we need to understand that faith, our faith, does not neuter our hormones. Doesn't. It's possible for the godliest of men and women to burn with passion. Because Paul says it's better to marry than to burn with passion, and he's writing to a Christian church. It's what you do with those raging hormones that's crucial and critical. Added to that, this was the boss's wife. As Matthew Henry says, it was his place to obey and in his interest to oblige. He was taking a huge risk in resisting her advances. This was a very, very powerful temptation, a temptation to which many had yielded before and since, not least of all, King David himself. The strength of the temptation. This was a strong temptation. Secondly, notice the repetition of the temptation. Notice there, verse 10. And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her to lie beside her. You see, this wasn't a one-off indecent proposal. This went on day after day. Now, you will know that in your faith there are times when you're stronger than others. And the danger is that you're tempted at a time of spiritual weakness. Well, you see, Joseph's temptation went on day after day, and it took great fortitude to resist that persistent temptation. You know, when Paul writes to the church in Ephesus, and he tells the church in Ephesus on the evil day to stand their ground, and after they have done everything to stand. He tells them to stand and stand again. He tells them never to drop their defenses, never to become susceptible to temptation. Never assume that temptations are one-off terrorist attacks. They are sustained bombardments from the enemy and with whom we are in a constant state of war. Beware of repeated temptations. So this was a strong temptation. It was a repeated temptation. And it was a secret temptation. Now, you see that in verse 11. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house. Now, do you see the subtlety of this? Sure, who would know? Not Potiphar, not the other servants, certainly not his family back in Canaan. No one would know. But Joseph would know. And God would know. And he couldn't go through with it. Now, secret temptations are always the most difficult to resist. You see, it's often pride that keeps us from sin. Pride can, of course, lead us into sin, but pride can keep us from sin. The humiliation of being caught, the scandal that results, the loss of influence in your community, in your society, in your church, those things can keep you from sin. But when a temptation comes like Joseph's secretly, the secrecy not only adds to the excitement, but neutralizes the consequences, at least in your mind. I can indulge my appetites without anyone finding out. Temptation and secrecy are a dangerous combination. That's why our Lord's temptation was so acute. He was led into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. But it's always important to remember that it's impossible to keep sin a secret, that sin surfaces. Be sure of this, your sin will find you out. So the temptation Joseph faced, a strong temptation, a repeated temptation, a secret temptation. The third thing I want you to notice is the strength that Joseph displayed. Well, as we know, in spite of the strength and the repetition and the fact that this temptation was secret, Joseph resisted and remained faithful and true to his faith. I want to examine how he resisted this strong temptation so that we can learn from him and garrison our own hearts in the face of our own temptations. Well, first of all, I think he identified the wickedness of the temptation. Look at verses 8 and 9. But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in his house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept anything back from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So there's the great wickedness of sinning against a man who put so much trust in him, but also the fact that he's sinning against God. Joseph identifies the sin as wickedness. He doesn't dress it up. He doesn't water it down. He calls sin, sin. You know, Anne Widdecombe, the conservative politician, but probably more famous for her appearance on Strictly, when she converted to Catholicism, she said she wanted to belong to a church that called sin, sin. Unfortunately, she joined a church that obscured the remedy for sin, but at least the Catholic Church calls sin, sin. Now, Joseph sees this temptation as a great wickedness and sin against God, a sin against man and a sin against God. You see, adultery, no matter what it promises, delivers hurt, pain, and suffering. To Joseph, it was morally reprehensive that he should betray the trust of his master and deceive him by stealing his wife. He is thinking of consequences, the results of his actions. You know, in our society, if you steal a man's watch, you might have a fine. If you steal a man's money, you might go to prison. You steal a man's wife, and it's just all a big joke. All is fair in love and war. You see, Joseph identified the wickedness of this sin. It couldn't be justified under any circumstances. You know, people try to justify this sin. Oh, you can't help who you fall in love with. He wasn't in a good marriage anyway. Sin is sin, and this sin is wickedness. Joseph pushes all that to one side, and he sees it as a wicked thing. But not only does he see it as a wicked thing in terms of his relationship to Potiphar, but he sees it as a sin against God. Look again at verse 9. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? In addition to seeing it as harmful to other people, Joseph saw his sin as an offense to God. How can I, he says, I who have known the grace of God and the forgiveness of God and the love of God, how can I do? It's one thing to have these thoughts in your mind, but to actually act upon them is another. How can I do this great wickedness against God? Offending human beings is one thing, but offending and defying the great God of heaven is quite another. And you see, in the last analysis, that's it. It doesn't matter if society tells me if it's right, or if my heart tells me it's right, or the other person tells me it's right. If God says it's wrong, it's wrong. And that's why David, after his adultery and his great confession in Psalm 51, says, "Against you, you only have I sinned and done evil in your sight." Of course he had sinned against Uriah. Of course he had sinned against Bathsheba. Of course he had sinned against the trust that was placed in him by the nation. But ultimately it was a sin against God. When tempted, don't let the devil dress it up and tell you it's not that too bad. Stand back and look at the effects of yielding to that sin will have on your family. Losing your wife. Rejected by your children. Not invited to your children's wedding. How terrible that can be. That's the first thing with Joseph. He identified the wickedness of the temptation. Secondly, he avoided the place of temptation. Look at verse 10. And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her to lie beside her. Notice this. Or to be with her. Or to be with her. Well, that seems sensible, doesn't it? Joseph avoided being with Potiphar's wife. He kept busy and he kept away. You see that in verse 13 where he left his cloak and ran out of the house and out of her presence. Paul warns Timothy to flee from youthful lusts. A statement which most commentators say is an allusion to this incident with Joseph. You see, temptations lose their power when you're not in the place of temptation. Do you remember how 2 Samuel 11 begins? That chapter that catalogues David's moral failure in the spring when kings go off to war. Well, he should have been leading his men into battle, but where is he? He's lounging about on the roof of his house, looking at a beautiful woman bathing. If he hadn't have been there, he wouldn't have been tempted. You see, sometimes when it comes to temptation, we have the desire, but not the opportunity. Sometimes we have the opportunity, but not the desire. But when desire meets opportunity, that's an explosive combination. That's why we must deprive ourselves of the opportunity. If you don't want to eat the forbidden fruit, stay out of the orchard. A friend of mine, pastor, who's now in heaven, died at the age of 46 in England, Bob Shane. His teenage son came to him on one occasion and says, "Dad, can I go on holidays with my girlfriend?" To which Bob said, "No, you can't." And he said, "Don't you trust me, Dad?" And he said, "Well, I wouldn't trust myself in that situation." Don't trust yourself. Don't make yourself vulnerable. Don't put yourself in the place of temptation. He identified the wickedness of the temptation. He avoided the place of temptation. And he knew his weakness in the face of temptation. Look at verses 11 and 12. But one day when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. As I said, Joseph ran from the place of temptation. But why did he run? Why did he not just reject her advances as he had done on previous occasions? Well, she was obviously more aggressive this time in her advances. She was holding on to his cloak. But Joseph was a strong young man, and he could have resisted her and verbally rejected her. Why did he take to his heels and run? Well, I believe at that point the temptation in his heart was very acute. She was close enough to hold on to his garment. She had pulled him into the smell of her perfume, to look directly into her eyes, to touch her body. And he knew if he stayed there a moment longer, he would have yielded. So he got out of there as quick as he could. He knew his weakness. Paul says, if any man thinks he stands, take heed lest he falls. You've got to be aware of your limitations and your weakness. None of us are above temptation. I remember being a little shocked when I first read in Robert Murray McShane's biography, something that he had, something that he had recorded in his diary. He says, the seeds of every sin are in my heart. It's all there. Our hearts are seed beds of sin and seed beds of every sin. And if you put yourself in the right place at the right time, that seed will burst into life. Sometimes the only answer is to run because of our weakness.
Shakespeare says, know yourself. You've got to be aware of your limitations in the face of temptation. You are weak and I am weak. And if the right temptation comes and the right opportunity presents itself, we will yield. That's why the Lord taught us to pray, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. You see, in that petition, we are acknowledging our weakness and our inability to resist strong temptation, that without him, we would utterly fall. Never, never believe that you're beyond temptation or you have outgrown temptation. You are weak and I am weak, and the sooner we realize that, the better. Joseph knew the danger he was in, and he took to his heels and he ran. Our heart is a tinderbox of combustible material, and one spark can ignite that into burning flames. As Matthew Henry said, the best of saints can be tempted by the worst of sins. You've got to realize your weakness and make no allowances for the flesh. The success Joseph knew, the temptation Joseph faced, the strength that Joseph displayed, and lastly, the consequences that Joseph experienced. Them that honor me, I will honor, is a biblical truth often quoted by believers, and of course it's true. But it's not always true in the short term. And it wasn't certainly true for Joseph in the short term. He ends up in prison. You will notice in verse 15 that Joseph left his garment behind. That garment, just like the coat of many colors, or as it's described, that marked his rank and his position. It was a distinctive coat that marked him out from everyone else. But Potiphar's wife uses that coat and makes up this story about Joseph forcing his intentions upon her. She's accusing him of attempted rape. Now, the fact that Joseph was imprisoned and not beheaded indicates that Potiphar did not entirely believe his wife, because rape was a capital, or attempted rape was a capital offense. But he had to do something. So here is Joseph honoring the Lord, and yet everything goes against him. False accusations, a loss of reputation, thrown into prison. F.B. Meyer asks, was it any good in being good? Could there be any truth in what his father taught him of good coming to the good and evil coming to the bad? Was there a God who judges righteously in the earth? And I'm sure those thoughts went through his mind. And I would suggest to you, perhaps the most acute temptation that he faced was not when he was in Potiphar's household, but when he was thrown into prison and he was tempted to question the goodness of God, the faithfulness of God, and the grace of God to him. I may have been tempted, as the psalmist says in Psalm 73, in vain I have kept my heart pure. I sought to honor the Lord, and yet everything has gone wrong. And it's bad. It's bad in the short term. But then our God is a God not of the short term, but of the long term. God was with him. You see that in verse 21. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him a steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. You see, God was still on the throne, and God was still working out his purposes in spite of this temptation and in spite of these accusations. And you see, if Joseph hadn't have been put in prison, he would never have met the cupbearer, and he would never have been introduced to Pharaoh. Now, we know the end of the story, but Joseph didn't. But we don't read of a murmur or a complaint. He just got on with his work. He knew that God would ultimately keep his promise and fulfill his word given to him in those dreams. John Calvin says, providence must always be estimated by its end. You see, when you're going through the difficulties and the problems and the setbacks, it's not always easy to see what God is doing and why God has allowed the thing to happen in the way that it has happened. But it's at the end that providence makes sense. And it's not to the point at the end of the book in Genesis 50 when Joseph can say to his brothers, you meant it for evil, But God meant it for good, that all of the pieces of the jigsaw fitted together. So we need to be patient with God. And we need to remember that God has a plan, that we do honor Him. We leave the consequences of our honoring Him to Him. And ultimately, He will work it out. Amen.